a work in progress, like a couple of years, and a slightly frustrating one. And there are some small results which I want to tell you about. And in some ways they're a little bit exciting, although you have to sort of understand the length and the frustration of the process to be excited by the small results. But they are interesting in a way, and what they have to do with is checking the ADS CFT correspondence at the level of string loops. Now, ADS CFT is of course something well known and should be well known to the audience. Well, maybe before I say that, I'll just acknowledge my collaborators and what I have to say. Most of the results is contained in these few publications, the last one of which I promise will be out very soon, but isn't yet. And there are actually two here, and the next one I haven't promised at all yet. But the others, you can see, go back a couple of years. And actually, I'll be talking about these almost in inverse order, which is also an interesting twist on the logic. And the main topic, as I said, is testing the ADS-CFT duality at the level of interacting strings. That's the string, full string coupling turned on, and testing it by trying to match it with the predictions of non-planar corrections in Yang-Mills theory. So ADS-CFT duality, of course, is the hypothesized, although many people would disagree on the word hypothesis. Some would argue it's practically a theorem, duality between maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory in four dimensions, the so-called N equals four super Yang-Mills with SUN gauge group and some Yang-Mills coupling constant, and the type 2B superstring theory on an ADS5 cross S5 background with five-form flux field excited with n units of flux, and the geometry of the background having one parameter, the radius of curvature, which is related to the string coupling and the number of units of background flux by this formula. And the ADS-CFT duality relates the parameters of string theory to the parameters of gauge theory by basically two formulae. The n here, which is the number of flux quanta on the string side, is equal to the n in the SUN of the gauge theory, and the string coupling constant is related in the usual way to the Yang-Mills coupling constant for the closed string theory coupling constant, the open string theory coupling constant that you get by looking at the low energy limit of disk amplitudes. And the duality roughly goes in the following way. It's a one-to-one mapping of all of the quantum states and observables of one theory onto the other. And on the string theory side, you have string theory states, that is states of strings in this background, and they map onto gauge invariant composite operators. And roughly speaking, the spectrum of the strings, that is their energy on this side, there are many quantum numbers, but one of them can be more or less identified with energy, that maps onto the conformal dimensions of composite operators in this gauge theory, which is a conformally invariant one, so a conformal dimension is something that actually means something there in a precise sense. Now, this is a weak coupling, strong coupling duality. Gauge theory is, of course, computable when its coupling constant is small, computable using finite diagrams, and string theory is very difficult to compute with. And in fact, things are really only computable in certain limits. And the first limit to be discussed in the context of ADS-CFT is the so-called supergravity limit. And that's the one where you first make string theory classical by turning off the string coupling. On the gauge theory side, if you turn off the string coupling constant holding the geometry fixed, that's this constant R, you do that by taking this combination of parameters, G string times N fixed, and turn off the string coupling, that's put G string to zero, that means you have to put N to infinity. That on the gauge theory side coincides with what's called the large N proof limit of the gauge theory, where you typically take large N, you tune the gauge coupling to zero in such a way that this combination of parameters remains a finite constant. On the string theory side, you can see things simplify quite a bit in the limit where this Tuff coupling is large then. So this argument was turning off, in a sense, quantum fluctuations of the string, that is projecting onto tree-level string theory. Tree-level string theory is still a very complicated subject, mainly because you still have a world sheet which fluctuates. So the world sheet doesn't branch anymore, you don't get string loops, but the world sheet itself still has a complicated internal dynamics. And one can make that semi-classical, or turn off that internal dynamics, by going to the limit where the string tension is large. And the string tension turns out to be something like the square root of this Tuff coupling. So the limit where string theory is really simple is the, first of all, the Tuff limit, and then the limit of strong Tuff coupling. And this is, of course, a highly non-perturbative limit on the gauge theory side. That does two things for us. First of all, it makes this duality really useful, because by doing string theory calculations, one can actually do gauge theory calculations in a regime which was previously inaccessible to any analytic technique. And at the same time, it makes this duality rather hard to check. It's rather hard to really check that it's right, because the analytic computations on both sides can be done, well, reliably in a domain where there's no overlapping domain of validity between the two limits. Now, of course, there have been many checks over time, and probably the most powerful one thus far is in the so-called plane wave limit of the geometry, and at the same time on the gauge theory side, it's called the BNN limit. And what's done there, I'm just going to sketch this. I'm not going to describe the limit in detail, because this isn't by any means a new story. It's already some years old. Most of the stories told in this paper, Bernstein, Molestein, and Nastasi, is where the initials B and N comes from, and it's, has this FTH number right here. But what it does is, on the string side, one takes the background geometry, which is AES5 cross S5, and takes a certain limit of it called the Penrose limit. In that limit, the metric turns into this PP wave metric. I haven't written the phi-form field, but the phi-form field with flux n actually becomes a constant in that limit, but n is also excited there. And the interesting thing about this background, technically interesting thing, is that at least non-interacting strings are exactly solvable in that background. And that was realized by Mitsayev quite early on, who worked out the string theory in the light cone gauge and the Green-Schwarz formalism and so on. But indeed, one can quite easily find the string spectrum, and it has some beautiful features. It was realized by BMN that the analogous limit can be taken on the super Yang-Mills side, and that things would be interesting there. And so they discussed that, in particular in the large N planar limit. So in the planar limit of gauge theory, one expects to find free strings. And that's more or less what they found, sort of a mapping between Yang-Mills theory in the large N planar limit and the free string states. And that mapping is sort of, well, it's a very beautiful one. It works beautifully. One can match the states and the spectrum, and to my knowledge, every detail of the non-interacting string with the planar limit of BMN operators. Quite early on in this game, not long after this, we were some of the first people that did this, but there was some discussion of putting in string interactions. First of all, by doing computations in non-planar Yang-Mills theory, and then by trying to match them with things, with the same things that you would compute on the string side. And that's the discussion which is still ongoing in what I'm talking about today. And it still doesn't have a satisfactory conclusion, as I'll tell you, and I'm not sure how much hope there is that it will be. There are some tantalizingly nice twists in the story, which make it look like one is close, but as usual, it isn't over till it's over, so at this point, it isn't really known. So the three screens on the plain white background, just let me review quickly what they look like. So this is the plain white metric. There's a five-form field that's a constant. This mu is just a parameter that you get by taking the limit. Notice that you can change it by doing a boost in x plus and x minus, because the x plus is here, x plus and x minus scale in a way that cancels, but in the x pluses it wouldn't, it would change the parameter mu. So it's kind of a choice of frame, if you will, in this plane wave limit. It also appears in the five-form constant field strength. The string theory on this background is exactly solvable in the light cone gauge. It's really easy to see why. If you imagine making the polytope string of this metric, if you make a light cone gauge on zaps like this, the derivatives that you get for the embedding functions coming from this term in the metric would just give constants. And so what you get is a kind of a constant term times x squared here, which looks like a mass term in the polytope action for the transverse fields. So in the light cone gauge, of course, the x plus and x minus are non-dynamical fields. In a sense, they're you get rid of them by gauge fixing. And the transverse fields are the propagating degrees of freedom. And all you get is mass of things living on the world sheet. So the spectrum looks something like this. The Hamiltonian is, of course, one of the light cone generators in that gauge. And it looks just like a bunch of free bosons with a mass living on the world sheet. So here is the spectrum, the square root of momentum squared plus mass squared. Well, the scale of the mass squared actually appears downstairs over in this term. And these are creation annihilation operators for world sheet bosons and fermions, respectively. So the spectrum is simply gotten by of a single string is simply gotten by a second quantization here. This is a string Hamiltonian in a sense. The only constraint left over is a level matching condition that says this thing has to be zero. And with that level matching condition, one can go ahead and construct states of a single string. So there's like a vacuum state of the world sheet sigma model, which is the lowest state of the string. It behaves in space-time sort of like a chiral boson. It has no excitations that go in the transverse directions at all. It has momentum along one branch of the light cone and zero momentum along the other branch. So in some sense, it's a chiral boson that propagates along the central axis of the space. The excited states, though, have other properties. It's not a Lorentz invariant spectrum. Notice it, it has this sort of a funny shape, and that's simply because the background doesn't have a local Lorentz symmetry. It has a sort of PP wave symmetry. But in any case, there are single oscillator states, which are very simple because they have to obey level matching, so they're only created by zero modes. Then there are two oscillator states that look something like this. Two bosons, boson fermion, two fermions, and so on. And their spectrum looks just like this. And of course, there are other many oscillator states, and one could go ahead and construct the whole spectrum. On the Yang-Mills side, one can actually find a very nice analog of all of these states, which I'll describe right now. So the dual of this theory is n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory in a particular limit. So n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory is a garden variety four-dimensional gauge theory on flat Minkowski space, whose only special feature, in a sense, is that it's maximally supersymmetric. So it's as supersymmetric as a four-dimensional gauge theory can be and be still local. To be supersymmetric, it has a bunch of fermions and scalar fields. These all transform into adjoint representations. Adjoint representation of a SUN gauge group. This theory is a superconformal field theory. It has vanishing beta function that can be demonstrated perturbatively, I believe, to three loops. And there are some non-perturbative algebraic arguments that claim it's true to all orders. So it has a conformal symmetry, that is, its space-time symmetry group is SO5-1, and then it also has an SO6-R symmetry. That's because there are six scalar fields here that transform like a vector under the SO6. Spinner fields transform like a spinner, actually like an SU4 spinner. And so the total bosonic part of the symmetry group is SO5-1 across SO6. And of course, that's made into some big supergroup by supersymmetry. The planar limit of this theory is now thought to be integrable, exactly integrable. That means there's yet a further infinite tower of conservation laws of some sort, which are sufficiently complicated that I can't really write them down for you. If it is integrable, in fact, the proponents of integrability seem to say that within a short time, this theory will be exactly solved, at least in some sectors, which is interesting news. Incidentally, the same free string limit of the type 2D superstring on ADS5 cross S5 is also thought to be integrable. And in fact, the integrability has very much the same structure as this one, although I think it hasn't yet been really matched in detail. Interesting operators in this theory, and ones that will be important to us, are operators that are made, are composite operators that are made by taking products of the scalar fields at the same point. Some of these operators are really special. If you take scalar fields and you symmetrize and make them traceless in these flavor indices, these are so-called, are half BPS operators, the so-called chiral primaries. They're special because their conformal dimensions don't actually renormalize. So they have tree-level conformal dimensions. In other words, just equal to the number of fields there, since each one has dimension one. That's interesting because, remember, conformal dimension is equal to energy on the string side. So this will correspond to some string state whose energy we know exactly. And in fact, these sort of operators do correspond to the supergraviton multiplet on the string side. And these are basically various Kaluza-Klein copies on the phi sphere of the supergraviton when you look at the correspondence from the string point of view. The state that one is interested in here to take the plane wave limit is one that has a very large angular momentum on the phi sphere. In a sense, to take the plane wave limit on the geometry side, what you do is you focus on a trajectory of a particle that's moving on a geodesic, which is an equator of the phi sphere. And on the anti-de Sitter space, it's moving in time, but otherwise just sitting at the center, or whatever the center would be. It's sitting at a point on the anti-de Sitter space and moving quickly on an equator of the phi sphere. And on the Yang-Mills side, the operator with the quantum numbers that describe states of string theory that are moving that way is one where you take a large quantum number limit. Now the phi sphere is on this side is seen through the flavor symmetry, and something moving on an equator of the phi sphere would be gotten by say taking a U1 subgroup of the flavor group by making say a complex combination of a few of the scalar fields, and then giving it a very large angular momentum quantum number by taking a large number of powers of it. And so this is a sort of composite operator that will be of interest to us here. And actually, this is one of the chiral primary operators. It is traceless and symmetric in its indices. So its spectrum is known exactly. And if you think of J as momentum and delta as energy, you can see it has a Fermat dispersion relation already. So this is one of the operators that one expects to survive in the plane wave limit. In fact, the whole holographic dictionary here is very well known, so just let me quickly review it. So you have this complex combination of scalars, which we call the scalar Z, and then you have the other leftover scalars. They nicely fit into a vector under one of the SU4s that's the symmetry of the background. Here, the eight transverse dimensions, as far as the geometry goes, look like they have an SO8 symmetry, but the background flux actually breaks that down to SO4 cross SO4. And on the gauge theory side, the SO4 cross SO4 quantum numbers are carried on one side, on the biosphere side by these quantities, and on the ADS side by derivatives of the field Z. The backend state of the string sigma model, the lowest state of the string, this thing I call the chiral boson, on the gauge theory side is just this operator with a large number of powers of Z. One has to take the number of powers large and coordinate the scaling within in a certain way so that the quantum number P plus works out. Actually, the quantum numbers P plus, how they map across to these operators I've given up here. So this, the equations up here are kind of a combination of the scaling that you have to do in the Penrose limit and just the identification of quantum numbers. So here's this null coordinate delta minus momentum. And then here there's some combination of these things that have to be scaled to take the Penrose limit. There one takes the large momentum limit at the same time as you take the flat space limit, r going to infinity, in such a way that actually this number p plus stays finite. And one could see that sort of scaling takes, I guess I haven't written it here, but it takes n to infinity in such a way that n divided by j squared stays finite. I think I've actually written down here. So it takes n to infinity in such a way that this constant stays finite and this constant stays finite. In the Penrose limit, it's this combination of things that sort of identified as the string tension. So the coupling constant of the world sigma model, or some vestige of the geometry on which a string is propagating, and this combination of stuff, which turns into the constant which controls string loops, the string coupling constant.
Okay, so is G Y M going to zero down there? I'm
Not necessarily, no.
No, not anymore. So it's n over j squared if it's finite, but that's gym. Right.
That's right. So in a sense, we retain interactions from Yang-Mills theory in that way. The g Yang-Mills is not sent to zero anymore. In fact, if one wants to turn this one off, in some sense, it's controlled by g Yang-Mills. Through this constant here is gm yes. squared. Okay. So if you want to hold this constant and turn this off, the way you do it is by turning off gm. Okay. So here, when we're talking about string perturbation theory in this constant, we are still talking about some kind of an expansion of gm. But it's a little bit complicated because this should somehow be finite, even when gm is zero. Okay, well, the spectrum of strings look like this. If we rewrite this in terms of Yang-Mills constants, this thing is just this lambda prime. So the prediction of string theory for the spectrum of these operators, the conformal dimension of, in particular, these operators, the two oscillator states, would be that it should look something like this. It should have a non-trivial conformal dimension. So this is at the planar level, and it should get a correction to all orders in perturbation theory, even in the planar limit, and they should sum up to this square root thing. And that was checked, also checked early on by in the original BMN paper to one loop order. So one loop is an expansion of this, the linear order in lambda prime, and then checked by someone else to the next order, to two loops, and there were arguments formulated that show that it works to all loops. As far as I know, they're only arguments, not really a theorem, but I think no one would doubt that it works to all loops. Those arguments were kind of a use of supersymmetry plus the conformal bootstrap, which I actually believe could be made rigorous if someone had the energy to do it. And so there's beautiful agreement, actually, between the spectrum of strings on this background of free strings and the planar limit of the Yang-Mills. So a rough guide to what else I'm going to say is on this rather dense looking slide, but let me guide you through it. So I've already said the first few things, that there's a very nice agreement of free strings. If you go to interacting strings, However, the sort of string interactions have been computed on the N mill side, at least to the first few orders, actually. And they've never been matched by string theory computations. One of the difficulties is just a technical difficulty on the string side, in that you really don't have many tools for doing interacting string theory here. Normally, the most elegant tools for interacting string theory is conformal field theory, where you do the Polyakov path integral for strings on surfaces of higher genus. Here, all one has is the light cone gauge, so conformal field theory is not available here. What one has to resort to is what is called light cone string field theory. In light cone string field theory, what you have to do is basically guess the form of, first of all, the interacting part of the string Hamiltonian, knowing the free form. That guess is guided by the symmetries of the theory and some ansatz of a locality. In known string theories, like the bosonic string on Minkowski space, it's a spectacularly successful guess. It actually is known to match conformal field theory to all orders. There's a one-to-one mapping between the analogous thing in string field theory there and conformal field theory. For superstrings, it also seems to work. But in this case, one doesn't actually have conformal field theory as a guide, so you make the same guess as you would have in the other cases, but you don't have much to check it against. You just have to hope that it's right. The other difficulty is that this plane wave is a maximally symmetric background, right? It has all the symmetries of ADS5 cross S5. And in fact, not quite as much symmetry as Minkowski space, but still has a lot. But in fact, its symmetry group is actually a group contraction of the ADS5 cross S5 symmetry groups. So the algebra is a little bit weaker. And in the end, it isn't quite powerful enough to determine the string vertex uniquely. There's an ambiguity of a prefactor in front of the string Hamiltonian. That ambiguity has to be fixed somehow. And the state of the art in these computations is to simply try to fix it by fitting the answer that you want. That's the Ann Mills prediction. But that is something that's left over and unknown, and one doesn't know how to check. Also, in this approach to closed string field theory, the string Hamiltonian has a three-string vertex, which is nice. Well, it's not very nice, but you can write it down. But it also has probably an infinite power of higher order contact terms. For sure it has a fourth order term, but probably sixth and eighth order and so on. And those contact terms, in a sense, have to be constructed with about as much effort as you construct the interaction Hamiltonian. So this is not an easy subject, in particular, to go to higher orders. Now, these things have been done, actually. Were done already early on. I'll show you the references in a moment. At the present moment, there are actually three competing versions of the vertex. One originally written about by Spradlin and Golovich. Another kind of kinematical version of it, which is much simpler actually, that was written down by DiVecchia, which is sort of known to have problems maybe with discrete symmetries, although that's not, I don't think that's known for sure. And then there's a version of it due to Yunea, which is kind of a linear combination. It takes half of this one plus half of this one. And the reason why he does that is because he claims, a claim which I don't fully understand, but he claims that it matches low energy supergravity better. Existing computations, which I'll also show you in a moment, are done using some simplifying assumptions. Some of the assumptions are justified, but one big one isn't really justified, and that's that they use a truncation of the vertex. And they basically use a truncation of the vertex, and they're calculating in perturbation theory, so it's some matrix elements. They truncate to where internal states that you insert between inside the matrix elements are truncated to basically two oscillator intermediate states. Even so, even with such a truncation, and I'll tell you why I think it's unjustified in a little while, even so, the initial calculations, which were done quite a while ago now by Spradlin and Golovich, they come tantalizingly close to just matching the gauge theory result. In fact, they thought they had it. And I'll explain why. And there was a bit of a cloud on the horizon, even in their original work, because they observed that if you looked at the next leading order of the stuff that was ignored when they did the truncation, that it actually gives a diverging result, apparently diverging. And if you resolve the divergence somehow, regulate, it seemed to give something non-perturbative, something that would be non-perturbative in the gauge theory as a leading order to the conformal dimension of some operator, something like square root of lambda prime, which is something that you don't expect to find on the gauge theory side because you're expanding in powers of lambda prime. On the Yang-Mills side, the loop corrections to a string energy level were calculated fairly early on, and I've given you a version of them here which goes up to two loops, actually using the integrability technology that's been developed in the last few years. I think this result's probably available up to four loop order, but up to two loops is actually the order to which it's been calculated by hard, good old Feynman diagrams without any assumptions about integrability or anything. So one simply computes the conformal dimension of the relevant operator. Here it is, the one loop perturbation theory in Yang-Mills theory, so to one order in lambda prime, and to one order in next to leading order in one over n squared, so non-planar diagrams. And here it is, the two orders in lambda prime, the same kind of non-planar diagrams. Notice one nicety of this thing, that somehow here is just equal to minus a quarter times the leading thing squared. It looks suspiciously like this expansion of the square root of some kind. I don't know why that is, but it is interesting. And translated into string theory quantities, it looks something like this. So remember, this is the mass of the world sheet scalars. And so this is like an expansion in the inverse of that mass. You would think that an expansion around heavy masses would be something simple. Well, it's not that bad. And the coefficient is, of course, a string coupling. Okay, so this is from the Yang-Mills side. Now, there's been a lot of work. I've listed some small subset of all the literature in the field that has been generated trying to reproduce this on the string side. And the most advanced version of this is already a couple of years old itself, about a year and a half, is by Penkiewicz and Guthyar. And what they get is this result here. So I've copied forward the Yang-Mills result, the Yang-Mills prediction in the top line. And I've taken their string result and translated it to Yang-Mills parameters. So this is what they compute using string theory. Now notice that it doesn't match, first of all. It's not the same expression. It is close in the following sense. You can argue that it is amazingly close.
Yeah, you
know. Well, okay. To make that argument, first of all, any function of n could have gone here. So there's already an infinite number of parameters that match. All the other structures you can have in n. Right? These are the same function of n. In fact, the only real difference is that this should be 70 instead of 65. If that were 70 instead of 65, it would match up to here. See, that's not bad already. It is pretty close. Then there's this awful thing. Now, this awful thing, if you've ever done thermal Yang-Mills theory, might not be that big a surprise. Non-perturbative stuff like this often comes when you have infrared divergences and you have to resum them, then you get a non-analytic thing in the coupling constant. And then it might not be a big surprise if nothing else matched after that, because usually once it becomes non-analytic in the coupling constant, the perturbation theory is meaningless anyway. So here you might think you're close, even if it doesn't look like it. a few things to say about this. Well, this most advanced available calculation still uses this two-impurity truncation. It uses a Spradlin-Volovich vertex. It fixes a prefactor to be one. That fitting, that prefactor is a sort of a fitting of this thing. So there's a prefactor, actually it should be F squared in front of this, which I suppose to match this term with this term, he said equal to one. Could have chosen some other term here. But in some sense, that's the most advanced version. And that actually corrects, supposedly, the previous one by Spradlin and Volovich, where they actually got this much more optimistic and correct-looking result. And they did it by exactly the same computation, but they added a factor of a half here, and they had well, I remember at the time thinking a convincing argument for why it should be there, about discrete symmetries and so on. I now believe it shouldn't be there, and the Pankiewicz calculation doesn't include it, so his result I consider more advanced than this one. But they have, in any case, it contains the interesting observation that here you're basically doing perturbation theory with some interaction Hamiltonian. It's second order perturbation theory. The first order perturbation theory is vanishing here because, I don't know, the string vertex changes two strings to three, so the first order doesn't have any diagonal matrix elements. Second order perturbation theory, well, there are still two terms in the Hamiltonian. There's this one, the three string Hamiltonian, and then there's a four string contact interaction, which has to contribute. And all you have to do is change a factor of a half in front of one of the terms, and the whole thing matches. Actually, it could be a factor of two over there, too, because it, there is a sort of overall fitting of the prefactor, which is an overall constant in the whole thing. Okay, so what have we done that's beyond this? Well, of course, we studied this problem in light cone string field theory, perturbation theory. There, actually, the natural expansion parameter is the square root of lambda prime. And in fact, the naive leading order, if you just count powers in all of the string diagrams, is the square root of lambda prime. So it's not a big surprise if something comes out looking like in leading order, it's the square root of lambda prime. But actually, it turns out that for some computations, these two contributions diverge individually. They're actually infinite. What's more, the string theory is supposed to be finite. There really isn't anything there to cancel divergences. So the two terms have to cancel against each other. What we've been able to show is that for these particular calculations to the energy corrections of the two oscillator states, that in fact the divergences do cancel. You can show it quite generally using the supersymmetry algebra, actually. You can use supersymmetry to rearrange these terms in a way that I'll show you if I have time. I might be running out of time by then, but you can rearrange the terms in the perturbation series to extract a factor of the energy. And after that, everything is power counting lower in dimension, and it converges. At the same time that divergences cancel, so do the leading things in square root of lambda prime. So they seem to go away. And this is a calculation of various two oscillator states, some of which seem to have things of order lambda prime and didn't. And the problem in the previous literature was what people did was they took a limit. You have to take a large mass limit on the world sheet, a sort of large mu limit, in order to expand in lambda prime. They would take that limit before they did the intermediate sums. And the first order would be convergent, and that's what they would go with. But if you actually look at the sum that you're doing, before you take the limit, it's a divergent sum. And you have to cancel singularities against each other. And they had the problem that some singularities didn't cancel if they didn't do that carefully, and lambda primes are left over. But if you do it carefully, the square root of lambda prime seems to go really on top. Okay, so that's another result which I won't be able to show you in detail because it's highly technical, but in fact it works out. So then we can show that the leading term is actually finite and begins with order lambda prime. Well, that's sort of good news. That means it's at least of the right form to reproduce gauge theory. Furthermore, canceling the singular terms more or less fixes a relevant factor of 2. And the half that Spallin and Golovich had apparently shouldn't be there. It shouldn't be there because in some other quantities, like the scalar amplitude, the things that they didn't compute, they would diverge, and they shouldn't diverge. That's unfortunate because they actually had the right result. And as I'll show you, it's even the story is even a bit more complicated than that. So just to give an idea of how the cancellations work, let me roughly go by how you construct a vertex. So there's really two inputs to the vertex. One is locality, that the world sheets interact only when they touch each other. So you kind of make a supersymmetric version of this delta function. So it's a space-time supersymmetric version. Right? There's a space-time convex term in the cubic Hamiltonian, and then with some of the fermionic oscillators added. And then there's supersymmetry, the supersymmetry algebra. And that you construct, in a sense, perturbatively, given that you already know very well how to solve the free string theory. So in the free string theory, you get this sort of quadratic component of the supercharge constructed. You also get the quadratic Hamiltonian, and the rest you want to fill in. And you want to fill it in so that the superalgebra works out. So in particular, the anticommutator of supercharges gives back the Hamiltonian. So this is the free string, and then you start putting interactions by, say, constructing a cubic supercharge and requiring that it's anticommutator with a quadratic supercharge gives what you would construct as a cubic Hamiltonian, has to be consistent because they should supercharge and commute with the Hamiltonian, and so on. And there are sort of higher and higher order ones. And in all of the computations I'm going to tell you about and all that have ever been done so far, the effects of Q4 in H4 are simply ignored. It's sort of assumed that Q4 doesn't have a tadpole term in it, which would contribute something to H4. And that might or might not be a correct assumption. At this point, it's not known. In fact, Q4 seems to be rather difficult to construct even on Minkowski space. Not much is known about it. OK, well, to see that H4 should be there, of course, is quite obvious from the superalgebra because it's just given by a commutator of anticommutator of supercharges. And what it does is it plays a role as a kind of a contact term. And for superstrings on Minkowski space backgrounds, it's known that those sort of contact terms are necessary in order to cancel divergences. So the divergence cancellation that we noticed is really not unknown. In fact, is very well known from other applications of superstring field theory. And it was one of the reasons for introducing contact terms in the first place. And in fact, the contact terms are even known in the conformal field theory approach, because it was noticed long ago that in conformal field theory, when you're calculating an amplitude, you know, something like that one, well, 4-point amplitude made out of these guys say that there were, superstring vertex operators have a bunch of prefactors in front of them, some derivative operators. When you calculate an amplitude, you insert them into the polyfill path integral. In order to do the calculation, you then have to integrate by parts. There are surface terms left over when you integrate by parts. There are terms at the boundaries of the moduli space of the Riemann surface. Then those things diverge unless you cancel them with something. So even in conformal field theory, you have to put in some kind of contact interactions like that with some specified vertices in order to cancel singularities. So the well-known error may also arise on this PP wave background. The vertex analytically looks something like this. So the vertex changes one string into two, or two strings into one. That fact is usually written by making it a sort of a direct product of three one-string states in the Hilbert space. And you think of ones with positive Lyapunov momentum as incoming and negative as outgoing, some convention like that. Then the delta function, one can represent as a kind of coherent state. Well, actually, this is a squeeze state made out of the string oscillators that looks something like this. So it's an exponential of quadratic things in the string oscillators. The star there really should mean dagger. And sorry about that, I don't know how to make a dagger with PowerPoint. So you get these sort of quadratic things upstairs, which represents the delta function. And then to satisfy the supersymmetry algebra after all that, you have to put some prefactor here. And the prefactor is, luckily I didn't write it, but for example, in H3, the prefactor is quadratic in the boson oscillators and up to sixth order, I think it's sixth order in the fermionic oscillators, and it's some big long thing. And for Q3, it's something of slightly lower order because, Q3 tends to be lower order. It would be like fifth order in the fermionic oscillators and so on. But there's some ugly prefactor which are more or less known except for one overall factor in front, which is a function of P plus, which is a thing that can't be determined by algebra. The large mu limit of the Neumann matrices I've written here is known in the sort of large mu limit. And it was computed can be written down here. See, it's a little bit complicated, but not that bad. It has some structure to it. And the idea is that one takes these things and does the perturbation theory that I was talking about on the previous pages. And the Hamiltonian is pretty complicated. And the reason for truncating to two oscillator intermediate states is just so one can do something at all. And notice that's a very severe truncation of this thing because, of course, it contains all oscillators in the intermediate states if you expand these exponentials, all numbers of oscillators. And truncating to two oscillators is really a very simple limit of these vertices. Okay, so the perturbation theory looks something like this. Let me just briefly tell you what supersymmetry does for you. And what I mean, in fact, by truncation of intermediate states, if you take H4, which is here, and plug in the supersymmetry algebra, it's an anticommutator of Q3s and Q2 and Q4. So this term is a term that's always ignored, although we don't really have to ignore it here. It's just that the structure of Q4 is completely unknown at this point. Plug H4 into here. And then use the supersymmetry algebra, one can actually rearrange this matrix element to look something like this. So this is just algebra, playing around with algebra. And what is so great about the final result? Well, I've arranged everything so there's always a Q2 operating on an external state. So here, and over here, and then down in here, it sort of comes automatically. And Q2, in a sense, contains the square root of the energy. And when it operates on an external state, you get the square root of the energy just coming outside. It doesn't have a summation over internal states associated with it. And it extracts just enough of the scaling dimension of the stuff inside here that it actually makes these things finite. And so you get a manifest cancellation of the singularities that you would get in here and here separately by combining it this way using supersymmetry. So that's at least a rough picture as to why it's finite. Of course, I have ignored all of the indices and so on here. And here I'm saying what I've already said in words. And in fact, now if you power count, it isn't at all obvious from this formula. But if you ignore these last two things and just count the orders of the matrix elements up here in the limit where the mass of the oscillators is really large, the leading order does look like it's lambda prime. And then there could be a lambda prime to the 3/2 and lambda prime squared and so on. The expansion parameter is really lambda prime to the 1/2. Okay, another thing we did is we've considered the different kinds of vertices. The vertex that was written down by Dubecki et al. Is exceedingly simple. It's one that's trivial on Minkowski space, and in fact doesn't have a good Minkowski space limit here. But here it's non-trivial, and it's kind of interesting, mainly because of its simplicity. All it does is, it, in a sense, realizes the supersymmetry algebra at high order by using it in lower order. So it says that the cubic supercharge takes this vertex, the thing which is the three-string state with Neumann matrices acting on it, and acts on it with the quadratic supercharge. And then one should also project on the level mass states. There's a few extra technical things. And the cubic term of the Hamiltonian, similarly with the quadratic Hamiltonian, acting on all of the three legs. And this actually does, to the order we're interested in, give a realization of the supersymmetry algebra, and is an acceptable vertex from that point of view. The Onea vertex is actually half of the, is a linear combination of half of the previous one plus this one. Exactly linear combination of this order. Now this is not really a linear process, so higher orders get complicated. But here, this order is just a linear combination. So what we've done is we've redid previous computations with two impure intermediate states with this vertex, and there's what we find. At this order, it matches the gauge theory result exactly. So this correction of adding on the Dyvekia vertex, Unea's correction in a sense, with an adjustment of the prefactor, fixed up the previous result. It was beautiful. And we made the mistake of calculating too much, because if you go to two loops, it's no longer quite as beautiful. It actually misses, you can compare with this, by a factor of a half. And I'm standing here telling you I can't find a factor of a half. If I was your graduate student, you'd probably tell me to go back to work to try, but we have tried and tried, and it looks like the factor of a half is for real. So it comes much closer, actually, which is really intriguing. Now, I have no real reason to believe that this two impurity truncation is a good one, but it's just intriguingly close. And further to that, if you did the same fudge of including a factor of a half or a relative factor of two between the two terms of perturbation theory and adjust the prefactor, you can actually fix this up to where it fits exactly of the two loops. That's the other very intriguing thing. And in this direction, it's about all I have to say. And I'm not quite out of time. I'd like to explain a different direction a little bit to you. But up to here, it's intriguingly close to something that works. And the only thing I'm doing beyond this, stuff, is I'm actually studying the Dyvekia vertex, because I think I can compute it to all orders and study whether the truncation just for it is justified. And that I haven't done yet. It's complicated, but just on the boundary of being tractable. Okay, well, this I said that. Okay, well, there's another direction which I've also found quite interesting, and it seems like I've only left myself 5 minutes, so it's going to have to be a rather abbreviated description of it, and that's to look at another kind of plane wave limit. And this plane wave limit you get by, first of all, orbifolding ADS5 cross S5 to create a theory with less supersymmetry. The orbital folding breaks half of the supersymmetries. So on the gauge theory side, you get an n equals 2 superconformal Yang-Mills theory. On the string theory side, you get an orbital folding of 5-sphere, which is kind of an orbital fold geometry. This was suggested quite some time ago already by Mookie and collaborators, where they even examined taking a plane wave limit of this orbital folded theory. So the main idea there is what you do is pictorially something like this. What we're going to produce in the end is the same plane wave metric as I was talking about before, but with one additional parameter. And what that parameter is a sort of periodicity of the null direction. So what you get is a plane wave space with a periodic null direction. And on that space, one can also solve type 2B superstring theory quite easily. It's called discrete light cone quantization. And the only real difference is that the light cone momentum is discrete. And that will be a real advantage, as I'll describe in a moment. But the way that you get it is by taking an overfold of the phi sphere and then taking a Penrose limit, say, along this equator of the phi sphere in such a way that you keep the physical length of one of the unit cells of the orbifold finite as you take the Penrose limit. So the Penrose limit is a flat space limit. In order to keep this finite, this length finite, you actually have to scale the order of the orbifold group. So if here the order of the orbifold group is m, there are m of these slices as you go around. So the total group was mn, and the radius of the space to begin with looks something like that. The idea is to keep this thing, which is this length, basically finite as you put m and n to infinity, and keep gn mills finite. Okay, so this m plays the role of j squared in the previous stuff, and you get basically the same story, and you can do this on both the string side and on the n mill side. And again, there's a very nice matching of the free string and the planar limit of Yang mills. You can match the quantum numbers and operators and so on. First of all, let me tell you the advantage of why I like to do this. And that's that string interactions simplify a lot. If you do discrete Lightbohm quantization for small numbers of units of Lightbohm momentum, that's because the Lightbohm momentum now has to be an integer. It has to be positive. Zero isn't even allowed. It has to be 1, 2, 3, 4, so on. And so if you keep the total number small, the string breaking and joining problem is just finite. The Hilbert space, say, if k equals 2, either has one string with 2 units or 2 strings with 1 unit. And so you can think about diagonalizing the full string Hamiltonian. And of course, on the string side, this is still a challenging problem. But on the Yang-Mill side, you can actually think about solving these things to all orders in 1 over n just by diagonalizing a 2x2 matrix. So you can, in a sense, get predictions on the Yang-Mill side to all orders. And even on the string side, it looks like this should be a problem that one can check. So it has this rather unrealistic from the point of view of the real world, but technically rather fascinating scenario where you can deal with string interactions in a much more tractable way. The gauge theory that you get by orbifolding is the so-called quiver gauge theory that looks something like this. So here, A, Bs, and Phis are scalar fields. The dots are gauge groups. So you get a whole bunch of gauge groups, and you get scalar fields, which are bifundamentals. That is, they transform from one side under one gauge group and the other side under another one. And then you get a bunch that are adjoint that transform sort of both sides by the same gauge group. And so the field content looks something like that. The analog of a BNN operator looks something like this. So in order to make a gauge invariant operator with the same quantum numbers, what you basically have to do is take an operator that circulates around the quiver some number of times. And the right operator is one of these, say A. And so you take A going around the quiver and then around and around again. And that makes the analog of a BNN operator. And then the BNN limit here is taken by making these M very long. So making these units long, but the number of units is just fixed. And actually, the number of units turns out to be the number of units of Lightbohm momentum. And then you can make other BNN operators by inserting a few impurities here. And now you don't quite have the symmetry of the old BNN story, because there we had only one kind of field. And so we had a symmetry under permuting things around the trace. Here, there's really inequivalent positions for inserting, say, the first impurity. And if you have a whole group of impurities, there's inequivalent positions for the whole bunch. And the momentum of the group of impurities along this chain, in a sense you can sort of diagonalize it by Fourier transform again, you have a momentum for it. The momentum along the chain corresponds to a quantum number on the string side. And what it is the wrapping number of the string whirl sheet around the compact null direction. So there's two new quantum numbers here that weren't in BNN, the sort of number of these things, which is Lightbohm momentum. Well, that was sort of there, but it wasn't discrete. And then there's a wrapping number, which is the sort of momentum along the chain. And that sort of begs to be key dualized. in some sense. If a wrapping number is momentum, and momentum is a wrapping number, and the T-dual of this theory is something that can be studied and is something interesting, but I don't really have time to talk about it here. Although it seems like the last seminar you had might have had something to do with it, the one a week ago. Okay, well, we can take the Penrose limit now and work out the spectrum again. The thing that's eased up a little bit is level matching, because now I have a wrapping number, so level matching condition contains wrapping and momentum quantum numbers. But otherwise, things are pretty much the same. You have massive oscillators on the world sheet with a spectrum that looks like that. Then you have discrete light cone momenta. So there are string theory states which are eigenstates of this Hamiltonian. There's again a vacuum which has two quantum numbers now, light cone momentum and wrapping number of the world sheet on the compact direction. To satisfy level matching, the lowest state should have zero wrapping number. Basically, level matching says that this integer times this integer should be the level number of oscillators. So you can now satisfy level matching with a single oscillator state with non-trivial momentum. So with the single oscillator state already has a dispersion relation, which you can hope to check in Yang-Mills theory. So it's already somewhat richer than the other VNN story, where single oscillators were trivial. And then multi-oscillator states, of course, their level matching condition looks like this, and they have well, the energy that you would expect them to have by applying the Hamiltonian. Now, there's a whole holographic duality story where you can map all the quantum numbers and all kinds of operators, and it's really very beautiful at the free string level, and I don't really have time to talk about it here. Holographic dictionary and so on. Then I think what I'm going to give you is just an example where, a few examples, where you can actually, for a small number of units of light cone momentum, find exact eigenstates of a dilatation operator up to order one loop in the Yang-Mills theory. We had actually done this to order two loops, but I couldn't rope together the formulas in a form I could present in the seminar. And we've also done things like finite size corrections. So there are some results we have that I'm not reporting here, which are interesting. But these are interesting enough. So if you say take a one-imperial state, which is here, and say one unit of light cone momentum, so just one chain, that should already have a dispersion relation like this, where k is equal to 1. And compute the action of the dilatation operator on it. You can show that it's an exact eigenstate of the dilatation operator, in fact. That's because the one-loop dilatation operator in Yang-Mills theory simply moves it along, or it can break the trace and reassemble it into two traces. But that actually can't be done here in a gauge invariant way, so that process isn't allowed. So with one unit of light cone momentum, string breaking is not allowed. There's no such thing as a string interaction. And so it's an exact eigenstate. And there's the eigenvalue, and then the VNN limited indeed goes to what you think of as a, to what is a Taylor expansion of this thing up to one power in the Yang-Mills coupling constant, like so. So that matches beautifully, and in fact, you could do it for k being any number. It's basically the same story. Technically, the eigenstate of the dilatation operator should be a superposition of things like this, and you find that in the VNN limit, actually, the superposition isn't needed because string breaking, again, is suppressed here. This is some sort of protected operator. The protection here is because of supersymmetry, not kinematics anymore, because now you have some numbers of light cone momentum. But indeed, you get this result to leading order in the VNN limit without any string interaction corrections. So this seems to be something which, in Yang-Mills theory, gets results to all orders in the Yang-Mills coupling constant, but only contributions from planar diagrams. And I don't know many examples of things in Yang-Mills theory that are like that. Actually, there are some in the diagram Gatha story, but they're quite rare, and this is an example of one. So the corrections for the one impurity spectrum. Okay, for k equals 2 and 2 impurities, one can also find the exact eigenstates of the dilatation operator. There are a few that don't seem to renormalize again beyond the 1 over n level. And then there are a few which one can find the spectrum, the exact spectrum of, to all orders of 1 over n. And it actually truncates just at the leading non-planar order. So here's the planar diagrams, which just matches the kinetic energy of the string theory side. And then here's the non-planar correction. And it appears to be just a constant. There's plus or a minus correlated with these plus or minus signs. So the only difference between the two operators is this stuff plus this stuff, or this stuff minus this stuff. They're both eigenstates of the dilatation operator, and this is the eigenfunction. Okay, so the N Milt side makes some pretty nice predictions here, which are a bit of a challenge to find on the string side. There's a few other interesting things one can say, and that's that here we found the exact eigenstates of the dilatation operator. So you can ask, well, what happens when you turn off the string coupling? Well, up here, nothing much happens. If you turn off the string coupling doesn't appear in any of the coefficients here, so nothing happens. So the smooth limit as you turn off the string coupling here are things that actually aren't single trace operators. They're some kind of complicated multi-trace operators. And that really suggests some subtleties with this sort of single trace basis here. But indeed, it's a fact in this case, which you just learned by doing this. Also, there are a bunch of protected states which must be protected for some combination of supersymmetry and kinematical reasons. The reason why they're protected, I fully understand. Well, one can do the same thing with three impurities. It gets more complicated. Actually, there one can find some exact eigenstates. There are some combinations of three impurity in the three impurity basis which don't renormalize at all to this order. Here we can only do the sort of first planar order. Well, that's not actually true. We can only do the first planar order in some cases. There's some that don't appear to renormalize at all to the one loop order of Yang-Mills perturbation theory, but apparently all loops in string theory. Some that have basically the same renormalization as a k equals 2, it truncates at the first order. And then some that seem to get all orders in 1 over n. And the all orders in 1 over n, here this is a shift of the naive order by something like this. That's what's expanded here and here. And that naive order comes from finding lambda, which is the roots of this equation. And momenta actually come out of the roots of this equation by knowing that the cosine hyperbolic is periodic in the imaginary direction. So that's how you get these integers, and the rest of this stuff sort of follows by finding roots. So in a sense, you have exact eigenstates of k equals 3 and so on. What about on the string side? Okay, well, on the string side, you know my conclusion is immediately so. On the string side, we have actually looked at the Lycone string field theory, perturbation theory here. And for two units, we actually get our result exactly in the two impurity approximation. It's the only one that I know comes out exactly. And it comes out exactly at one loop and two loops in the Yang-Mills theory. It's really quite beautiful. And again, it's an unjustified truncation of the full vertex. And what we're doing right now, which we haven't finished doing, but seems like the logical step is to try and test the validity of the truncation. And the only way to do that is to calculate the leading orders of the stuff that's been truncated. And so what we're doing right now is we're calculating the same amplitude, but in the four impurity channel. And that computation will take a finite amount of time. And if it's zero, it would give some confidence that there's some supersymmetry reason, probably supersymmetry, why the higher impurities aren't contributing. There doesn't seem to be any other reason why they wouldn't have been. And if it's non-zero, then we have yet another one of these mysteries where something works but is unjustified, and if you calculate a little bit farther, it doesn't work anymore. And in conclusion, I guess I could leave you with the thought that this is still an open and interesting problem, matching a non-planar Yang-Mills and string loops. Thank you. Questions? Well, let's start again.